If you weren't alive during the first Super Bowl, odds are you've only seen clips from it. But thanks to new efforts by the NFL Network, football fans were able to see the full game for the first time on Friday. We'll have that story coming from Bill Glauber later in our show. Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. If you've been to a theater performance in Milwaukee, you might have noticed a pair of performers just off the stage using their hands to tell the story. Journal Sentinel reporter Meg Jones went behind the scenes with these American Sign Language interpreters. They act as a microphone and translate for deaf theater patrons who want to experience the performance just like everyone else. Meg sat down with Chelsea Lewis to talk about the interpreters and how they prepare for their roles as ears for the deaf.
I was at a rock concert actually last summer at the Pabst Theater. I went to see the Brian Setzer, George Thorogood performance, and it was interesting because there were two ASL interpreters that were there, and they had a music stand, and they were signing all of the words to all the songs, and I thought, huh, what goes into that? How do you do that? It must be kind of a subset within the American Sign Language interpreting community. So I thought, if I'm wondering how do they go about doing it, maybe others would be interested in reading a story about that. And I then got in touch with the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts. And they put me in touch with a couple of ASL interpreters that handle all the touring Broadway shows that come through town, as well as other events that they have at the Marcus Center. And so the way it works is that pretty much all the big touring shows, they'll have one performance that the ASL interpreters will work at. And then some of the smaller shows, if they're requested. And by the way, any deaf theater goer can contact the box office and ask for an ASL ASL interpretation. And it's not just that way too. They can get captions also for blind theater goers. They can get a headset, and they've got somebody in the control room describing everything on the stage. So it's really a neat way for people with handicaps that might not otherwise be able to experience the theater. It's a neat way for them to see or to hear a show just like everybody else.
So what goes into preparing? What do the ASL interpreters do to prepare for a show? Do they get the script ahead of time? How does that go?
So I met with Sandy Smith and Pamela Sukonine, who are the ASL interpreters that handle most of the shows coming through at the Marcus Center Amphitheater. And they've been there since the fall of 2002. So if anybody has seen the interpreters at a Marcus Center show in the last dozen years or so, they probably have seen Sandy and Pam. So what they do is, for example, I went through their whole preparation for Newsies, which was just in town earlier this month. And so for Newsies, they would have gotten the script and a CD of all the songs that are sung in the show directly from the producers of the show, which would have given them to the Marcus Center people. And they typically get that several weeks before the show. And then they read the script, and typically what they'll do is they try to envision, like, staging. They'll write notes. They'll listen to the music. They'll memorize the lyrics. And then the two of them get together and decide who is going to play which part. One will pick, one of the main characters, and then the other one will pick up all the other characters. But for Newsies, though, there were 31 named characters in that script, and these two women performed all 31 of those parts. So there's a lot of preparation that goes into it. I think also what I was surprised in, and a lot of people would be surprised to know, is that they don't translate every single word for word in a show. Basically, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get to the essence of what's being talked about and the essence of the songs. So they're always kind of, because they can't do every single word, and they can't fingerspell every single word either. So what they'll typically do is that they will fingerspell, like, say, a character's name for the first, like, one or two times, and then they'll go to a symbol. So, like, the main character in Newsies was a newsboy by the name of Jack. So they fingerspelled Jack first off, but then they would just sign a J, and that's how you'd know that was that character. Now, there are some challenges, though, because if you're doing 31 characters, how do you switch from one to the other? So They obviously use their fingers, they use their hands, they use their arms, but they also use their faces a lot as well, too. So a lot of the characters in Newsies have a very thick New York accent. So you can't sign an accent, but you can show that in your face. And they also use their faces to describe, because if you were signing a sentence literally that was meant to be humorous, you have to kind of show in your face that that's funny or it's disgusting or it's sad or all these emotions. And it was interesting because when I was watching Newsies, I saw Sandy, she was doing the main character, Jack, but there was times where she's in a scene where she's signing Jack's lines, and then immediately after that, like a small boy in the show was saying something, and so her face changed imperceptibly to show that she was signing that little boy. And so it was fascinating just sitting there watching them. So they always go to the first show that's in the run of the show, and they sit in the audience and they take notes and they kind of see like pace. Staging, for example, in Newsies, they were telling me that the songs that they were listening to on the CD, some of the songs were played slower in the actual performance than they were on the CD, something that they need to know. So it was kind of fast. So it's many weeks of preparation. And yes, they're not dancing and climbing the scenery, but it's just as exhaustive for them because they're always on. They're standing there for the entire time of the show, and they're doing everybody's parts.
Now, Meg's story hasn't come out yet. You can find it in Monday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and online at jsonline.com. Fans of contemporary dance received some bad news on Wednesday. Alverno College is ending its Alverno Presents series after 56 years. Why has the series been canceled? Editor Jim Higgins has the answer.
It really boils down, as it often does, to money. Alverno College has been subsidizing this series for years. As David Ravel, the artistic director, said, almost every college-sponsored performing arts series is subsidized. The college in this series wanted to present certain kinds of work that may be artistically important and challenging, but isn't necessarily commercial. And Mary Meehan, the president of Alverno, said, at present, the series costs about $500,000 to produce each year, and even with ticket revenue and other income, Alverno ends up subsidizing about half the cost of that series. And the college has a high percentage of students who receive some sort of financial aid. And President Meehan said they're really looking at every dime they spend to make sure they have the resources they need for their students. And reluctantly, they feel they need to end the series for that reason.
So if you're a student at Alverno and the series played any sort of role in you deciding to go there, what does this mean for you?
There may be students who feel strongly about the series, but President Meehan said, really, from the beginning, this is a series that has been offered to and pointed at the Milwaukee community. Alverno hasn't seen this primarily as a service for their students. This series began almost 56 years ago with Sister Laura Lamp started it to kind of fill niches in Milwaukee that weren't met elsewhere with choral music and other kinds of performances. And that's really what it's become. It's a series for Milwaukeeans who are interested in world music, dance, and cultural performances. And there isn't really any sign that this is crucial to a large number of Alverno students, per se.
So if you're a community member and you're going to miss these performances, where can you go to kind of fill this niche of high art performances that maybe aren't as commercial?
Also, as President Meehan said, there was a point where Alverno might be the only promoter staging these kinds of shows. I'm not going to tell you can replicate everything you might have seen with Alverno Presents, but the Wilson Center in Brookfield staging some of these sorts of things. The Pabst Theater Group is staging some of these kinds of performances. The South Milwaukee Performing Arts Center has really come on strong in unusual music and world music performances. David Ravel is going to continue his Uncovered series. This is a series where local musicians are reinterpreting the music of American songwriters, from Stephen Foster to Patti Smith. And it's always organized around one person or concept. He has an arrangement with the Pabst Theater Group to do two of those shows next season at Turner Hall. So that little piece of this will live on. And I guess, you know, the world music and dance junkies will have to look around to other series in town to, you know, and of course, to read the Journal Sentinel at tapmilwaukee.com, because we'll tell you about those things.
Now, my reaction was to be surprised, but what was your reaction to finding out that this series is going to be canceled?
It was surprise, but it kind of the surprise is immediately tempered by the knowledge that, you know, this is not a kind of thing that pays for itself. And like David Ravel said, you know, everything comes to an end, and they've had an amazing run. I mean, this has always been a very daring series about what they presented. Contemporary dance touring performances don't make money for anybody. You always have to pay money to put that work on. I mean, dance is an integral part of every culture in the world, but no one has found a way to make it commercial yet. Ravel said it's been a great run, both for him personally and for this series, so surprise, some sadness, but it's not inconceivable that the college will decide, you know, we have to use this money elsewhere.
That news broke last week, but if you're looking for more information on the parts of the series that will continue on, visit tapmilwaukee.com. I'm going to do something a little different for this week's JS on Politics show. Instead of airing a clip from Thursday's show, I sat down with editorial page editor David Haynes to talk about how he balances the political news that ends up on his page. First question, I know a lot of people, if you rewind to the recall election, were either disappointed or enthralled with the stance that the Journal Sentinel's editorial board took on it. Now, for the people who were disappointed, a few of them felt as though they should cancel their subscriptions or otherwise react to it. How would you say to people who are of that mindset, maybe, you know, explaining to them the differences between the news section and the editorial section?
Clearly, there is a separation between the two. The news side does what they do. We do what we do. They don't tell us what to print or publish on our digital platforms, and we don't tell them what to do. And even if we did, they wouldn't listen to us anyway. So the recall editorial is an interesting sort of animal to talk about, because we had endorsed Governor Walker the first time in 2010 as an editorial board, primarily because we felt that Walker was better on jobs at the time. Of course, keep in mind, we knew nothing about Act 10 and that was coming. And we thought that he was going to be stronger than Mayor Barrett in dealing with the public employee unions, which obviously turned out to be true, but we thought later he had gone way too far and we opposed him on that. When the recall came around, we talked about it and considered whether we should have an endorsement at all, and decided finally that we should, and we should get into it for this reason. We believe strongly as an editorial board that the recall was a colossal overreaction to a single issue, and that was not the proper use of the recall process. And so that for us became then a question about should Walker be retained in office or not. And we decided that he'd been elected to a four-year term, he should get his four-year term. Now, if you ask us now, would we have endorsed Governor Walker the first time around had we known then what we know now? We'd have to ask that editorial board, but for me personally, no. But that was the reasoning. So anyway, when it gets to people being upset about it, I get it. But those were the reasons that we made those decisions.
Well, and I feel like when people talk to me about it, I often explain that the editorial board doesn't even sit in the same room as
right.
the news department, that it's so yeah. separated, and that you should consider the editorial board as a voice and the news as news, and really delineating between the two of them is the best way to approach your content.
Right. That's right. And I think it's important to note, too, that our mission is to provide a forum for discussion about the issues of the day in this region and this community. It's the forum that's really important. That's what we do. We provide what Oliver Wendell Holmes in that famous Supreme Court case in 1919 called the marketplace of ideas. And when we do that, it provides people with a chance to have their own ideas challenged and maybe affirmed, but to provoke them to think about the issues. That's what we do. Now, the tools we use to do that are space in our printed paper, space on our digital platforms for people to have their say, our editorials, and columns that those of us who write opinion write. And it may come as a surprise to people, but the columns and editorials, while we hope they're persuasive, they're really meant to provoke people in the best sense of the word to think. That's really the bottom line. We want them to think and to come up and sort of make up their own minds about what they think.
In creating this marketplace of ideas, how do you ensure that different perspectives are represented?
We seek them out. And that's an really important point, a great question. We've had, as I don't think it's a surprise, a reputation that's been flogged by talk radio and others for being a liberal newspaper. In fact, our positions are pretty center and moderate. But we find it really important to go out and find conservative voices. That's one of the reasons we have Christian Schneider, a conservative from Madison, write for us. That's one of the reasons that I asked Brett Healy from the MacGyver Institute in Madison to write a piece for us recently. But we also seek out liberal voices, try to find more female voices, which is a real problem all over the country. It's interesting. Op-ed pages tend to get a lot more submissions from men than women. There's even a project at Stanford called the Op-Ed Project that tries to train women and minorities to get their pieces into news organizations. So we make a real concerted effort to try to represent the vast majority of the people in the area that we serve.
As the editor of the page, do you feel that when you're writing, you need to be somewhat impartial, or do you think that someone who has read your columns for years, it wouldn't be problematic if they could perhaps locate which side of the aisle you tend to fall on?
So I started writing a column about a year ago, and I did that because I thought that in the age we're in, where personality becomes more important in social media and online, that it was important that we gave our opinion journalists the chance to be out there with columns. And then be out there with social media, of course, too. But I have, you know, I tend to be moderate right in my politics. I would describe myself, this doesn't exist any longer, but as an Eisenhower Republican, so a moderate Republican, a moderate sort of conservative. And so I don't have any issue with if people want to sort of peg me one way or another. But that is sort of beside the point when it gets to the main thing that we do, which is provide the forum. That forum's open to everybody. I mean, we're not going to let someone call Governor Walker or President Obama Adolf Hitler. We're not going to let someone call for the violent overthrow of the government. But aside from those vast extremes, there's a lot of acreage on the field to play in. And so anybody can really get access to our pages and have their opinions known, no matter what my personal views are.
Of course, you can read our editorial coverage in today's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, or you can find it online. That's jsonline.com/opinion. And if you're interested in submitting your own letter to the editor, there's a form available on our website as well. You can also email your letters to David at dhaynes@journalsentinel.com. And now the segment you've been waiting for. Just how did the NFL Network end up re-airing the first Super Bowl? Reporter Bill Glauber has the answer. So Super Bowl I hit the airwaves Friday night. What did it take to produce that?
Well, it wasn't an actual rebroadcast of the game. NFL Films had to cobble together 145 plays from its archives. It took them months to do it. So you didn't see a rebroadcast of the game, but you saw every play as filmed by NFL Films.
And that's because it aired on two networks, correct?
It aired on two networks, NBC and CBS. One held the rights to the old American Football League, the other the National Football League. And over the years, those tapes were taped over. There is one surviving copy left that we know of. It's not fully complete, and there's litigation to do with it. So that, who knows if we'll ever see that.
Now, who did you talk to for this story, and what was the most interesting part of doing those interviews?
I spoke to the last surviving broadcaster, Jack Whitaker, who's 91 years old, and he talked about being apprehensive before the opening kickoff. Talked to Jerry Kramer, and Jerry Kramer had never seen the game. He had played in it, had never seen it. And then I talked with an official from NFL Films who discussed cobbling the project together.
And what did you think was the most interesting part of those interviews?
Well, not the interviews, but the most interesting part of the whole thing was to see just how archaic and old it all looks. And I'm old enough to remember watching that game, flicking around from channels 2 to 4 in New York. And, you know, to see the game 49 years later brought back a lot of memories. And boy, oh boy, those quarterbacks took a beating back then.
How did you find out about this?
Well, you know, NFL Films made the announcement this week that it had finally gotten the entire project together, and so just went and made some phone calls.
In past roles, you were actually a sports reporter. So when it comes to these kind of stories, the ones that maybe have some nostalgia involved in them, what do you think makes them so compelling for readers?
I think people mark their lives by events, by what they see on television, by what they experience in their lives, and by a mass event. They were there then. And I think that sports tends to mark it for people. They remember where they were when a certain big home run was hit or a certain game was played. And certainly with the Green Bay Packers, there is nostalgia. You know, everybody in Wisconsin is essentially a Packers fan. So I think that sports really provide a good point on a calendar for people to remember the way things were.
And especially because you'll be seeing Bart Starr as the quarterback in this, and now he's dealing with some health issues. He just recently broke a hip on top of the issues he had dealt with previously. I think it'll be nice for people like my grandma to, you know, who's been a fan of his since she was in her 20s, to see him once again on the field.
I think it is. And I think that, you know, for viewers or people who don't remember what it was like, it'll be their first time maybe to really see what these players did, how they played. The games, the people were smaller. The games were played at a slower pace. The athletes were not as fast then as they are now. But there was a toughness, especially in those quarterbacks and running backs. There's still toughness today, but you can really see it in some of these films. I mean, Bart Starr was playing with pads and not much more than that. And, I mean, he took a pounding in that game, as did Lenny Dawson of the Kansas City Chiefs. And, boy, it really is good to see those players when they were young.
Bill's story on this ran in Thursday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Once again, you can find a copy of that online at jsonline.com/sports. And that wraps up today's Behind the Headlines podcast. If you like today's show, remember that you can always subscribe to the show on both iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Thanks for joining us this week, and take care until next week.